We're here with Dr. Stephen Skinner. We've already been talking about some of the issues that have to deal with genetics and his and some of his specialties, since autism is one of your specialties. That was interesting, and since Caitlin works with autism, and that's her platform here for Miss South Carolina, that's pretty pretty neat to have that. I actually had a brother who was older than I was, who was born with Down syndrome. In fact, I never knew I had this brother until he died, because my family put him away, which is what you did with that. And I got to know him after, actually I didn't get to know about him until after my father died. And I got to know him and be part of my family. He actually was pretty old when he died. I think he was almost 60. So, but he had been institutionalized and all this kind of stuff. But what they do today with Down syndrome is just phenomenal compared to what my brother grew up with.
I think we're seeing that in a lot of genetic conditions, that the natural history today is different than the natural history we were taught in medical school. Because what we knew was based on individuals that, as you said, were put in institutions, and really people didn't give them much potential for developing, so they didn't put all the resources that we do nowadays in early intervention, all the different therapies, which does make a difference, I think, in people's
Absolutely.
Lives.
Yeah, my brother actually didn't speak, and I think it was because he was institutionalized, and he learned at an early age to be quiet and to survive and in the institution. Right. He ended up living in a group home and had a great life later in his life.
Right.
But, you know, we're supposed to be talking about you, not about all these other issues today. So, Dr. Skinner...
These other issues are much more interesting, I promise you.
No, where are you actually from? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Aiken.
In Aiken.
I was born in Athens, Georgia, but grew up in Aiken. Moved there when I was a year and a half.
Oh, okay. So you grew up in Aiken.
Grew up in Aiken.
And when you were growing up, what did you think you wanted to be? Have you delved into those resources there and thought about maybe what you wanted to be when you were a young kid?
I think there was a long list, you know, back as far as I can remember. There was no one in my family that was a physician or in medical or the healthcare profession, so there was nobody pushing me in that direction, but it's just a long list, and that was one of those things. And it was probably a little bit later, mid-adolescence, I guess, when I started stating that that was kind of a direction I was headed, but it was, I don't know, I really knew what it meant to be a physician or what that might entail as far as the future, but it sounded like a lofty thing to strive to.
It was.
Parents seemed to be excited about it, and so.
Yeah, so where did you go to school?
So I went to undergraduate at Wofford in Spartanburg, and then medical school at Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. And then my residency in Columbia. Yeah.
So how did you get from a general physician into genetics?
So when you don't know anything about medicine.
Okay.
The only thing I knew was general practitioner, because that's what I grew up with. I had a general practitioner that did everything from delivering babies to
That was the good old days, wasn't it?
So I started out in that path of family practice. So I actually started out in a family practice residency and did about a year and a half, and really enjoyed my pediatric rotations, really enjoyed the pediatricians that I worked with, and felt like that fit me better from a personality standpoint, and switched to pediatrics. So I then completed a pediatric residency. And then went to general pediatrics. I was doing general pediatrics in Georgetown, South Carolina. I did that for 4 years. So genetics really wasn't on my radar at all. We did not have a genetics course in medical school. It was part of another course, just a couple lectures about some of the very basics of genetics, but that was it. So really no exposure to it at all. I was doing solo pediatric practice, very busy, and had a young family, and was looking for a different lifestyle.
instead of working all the time.
Had a good friend who was living here in Greenwood and said, well, I think the genetics center is looking for someone. You need to come talk to him. And I really I said, I don't know anything about genetics. I'm not sure that's for me. But he kept insisting, so I came to at least visit, give it a look, and here I am.
There you are. That's right. Yeah. And how long have you actually been here at the Genetics
Center? So I came in 1987. So
a good long time.
I actually was recruited to help more with their, that time, everyone here did general pediatrics and clinical genetics. It's the only way we could survive, really,
right.
at that time. And so I was recruited more to help with their general pediatrics, but as I was looking and seeing what was going on, I said, this is kind of interesting. I probably should take advantage of it. And many of the patients that are the interest and focused here, which are pediatric patients with intellectual disabilities, birth defects, autism, were what I was seeing in pediatrics. So mm-hmm. it made sense to learn more about it. So I did a fellowship when I came here.
So, and here you are today, the director here at the Genetic Center.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be where the Genetic Center is today? It's really almost even at a bigger jumping off point than ever before with the collaboration with Clemson and the self-regional. I mean, the future here is just mind-blowing, isn't it?
We like to think it is. So yeah, this is actually our 40-year anniversary,
yeah.
Which we'll be celebrating next month. Laurie's doing a lot of planning for that. So yeah, it is a very exciting time. You know, when I look at all the people that it took to get here, it's very humbling to be in this position. But I think Dr. Stevenson, our founder, who's still here and still working, I'll put that to rest. Everybody asks me, how's Dr. Stevenson enjoying retirement? He is not retired. He's working very hard.
But he's painting, too.
He is painting.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
He's now can kind of focus on what he enjoys and what he wants to do. But, you know, he had a vision of genetic services and what he thought that would entail and bringing that to South Carolina. And
how did it end up in Greenwood, South Carolina, though? That, to me, is amazing that little old Greenwood, and that would have been back in, what, 1974?
1974 is the first time. So Dr. Stevenson is from South Carolina, from a small town, some actually outside of Nieces. So. And so his vision was to always come back to South Carolina and set up genetic services for the state. Mm-hmm. And in graduate school, he shared this with Hal Taylor, who also shared that vision, and the two of them basically co-founded this. But I don't think Roger knew how or where at the time. He had a childhood friend that he grew up with. It was practicing orthopedics here in Greenwood. Who he came to visit, who arranged a meeting, and I don't know who all was there, but Jim Self was there.
Mm-hmm.
I think Boykin Curry was there, Bob Irwin, and others that were influential members of the community. And he kind of shared his vision for genetic services and what it could do for the state and citizens of the state. And from what I understand, Mr. Self was very enamored, very taken by that vision, and decided that he was going to make it happen. And so I don't know the exact timeline, but I don't
sure.
think it took very long. I think just a matter of a few weeks. He called Dr. Stevenson and said, I've got it all arranged. I've got your funding. And basically, and somebody had a vision also at the state level. So our current Department of Disability Special Needs, which at that time was Department of Mental Retardation, part of their mission is prevention of disabilities.
Sure.
And someone in 1974, 40 years ago, said, well, to prevent disabilities, we need to know what causes them, and genetics is going to tell us that. And then once we know what causes them, then we can start preventing them. And so they put
that up... That was a smart person.
A very smart person. I mean, 40 years ago to think that, and to be willing to put half of the money to start the center on the table and
Absolutely.
Say, we're going to make this part of our mission. And they've continued since that time to make that the kind of the center of their prevention activities at the Department of Disability Special Needs. So for 40 years, they've been doing that. And Mr. Self said, well, I'm going to match them dollar for dollar. So,
I like that man.
But he said, under one stipulation, you got to be in my town. And so that's why we're in Greenwood.
Okay.
But I think most people that Dr. Stevenson talked to at the time said you can't make that work in Greenwood. You've got to be in Charleston or Columbia. You've got to be where there's a big hospital, a university, or a medical school. You'll never make it work in Greenwood, South Carolina.
And here we are, 40 years later.
Yeah, 170-something employees and located in five sites around the state.
Absolutely, because there's one in, what, Spartan?
So we have an office in Greenville.
Right.
Office in Columbia, office in Charleston, and office in Florence.
This is our
main campus. Most of our employees are here. Our diagnostic lab, research activities, educational division is all housed here, but we have clinical personnel in all our other offices. We have always tried to serve the whole state. So originally we had outreach travel clinics, and we would go all over the state.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yes. Yeah.
So we used to go to Bennettsville and Jasper.
Actually,
County.
I think Dr. Saul told me that. Yeah. I think because Dr. Saul, I've talked to Dr. Saul before, yeah, and about traveling to different areas.
Yeah, we used to go to everywhere there was a DDSM board or a workshop or a DHET clinic that let us see individuals. We'd go and spend a day or sometimes two or three days in the area seeing patients. But as the volume grew, we saw that it made sense to have these regional offices where we could have people there full-time, start meeting the needs of those various areas, and also meet the needs of healthcare providers in those areas too, to have physicians located closely for consultation.
And today you have the ability to do all kinds of genetic testing on not only children but on adults too.
Right. So our focus still is on intellectual disabilities, birth defects, and autism, but the technology applies to adults and children, and we do a lot of testing on all ages. And of course, with our intellectual disability patients, they don't go away when they become adults, so we
That's
continue
true.
To follow them or evaluate them if they're new to the DDSM system or our circumstances change. And we are starting to do more and more in other adult disorders and diseases, cancer, adult onset diseases as well now.
You know, it really is, if we go back and you look at the history of the genetics, it has to have been one of the most exciting fields that you could ever imagine to be in.
I mean, yes, because you're actually living history.
Exactly.
I mean, seeing things that are, you know, never before known or even thought about, and seeing that happen and developing and new breakthroughs, and the pace of technology is just astounding. It's just almost impossible to keep up with now.
It is. Now, why did you decide to study Rett syndrome, Angelman syndrome, and the autism? What made you go in that direction?
Okay. Well, the Rett syndrome and Angelman, I guess I raised my hand.
You were sitting at a table like this?
That has been a great experience. It's still going. So we had the opportunity to join one of the NIH rare disease consortiums. Gosh, that's now 10 or 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. So NIH recognized that there are a lot of conditions that are in genetics, but also other conditions that are rare. They just don't happen that commonly, and that physicians don't know a lot about them. There's not a lot from a treatment or a management out there, and mm-hmm. Families are desperate for information. So they started putting some emphasis and some funding towards these consortiums that were studying selected groupings of rare disorders. And we had the opportunity to join a consortium that was put together at that time on Rett syndrome, Angelman syndrome, and Prader-Willi syndrome. So Dr. Stevenson asked if there's anybody to be willing to to lead that effort. What he didn't tell me was that we were actually only supposed to be in one of those conditions, which I think at the time was Rett syndrome. I went to the meeting not knowing that, so I kept raising my hand. So we went from Rett to Rett and Angelman. Fortunately, I put it down for Prader-Willi. all three of them.
Wow.
But it's been a fantastic experience. Great families, learned a lot from the patients and the families, and some great researchers at other institutions that we've interacted with, from University of Alabama, Birmingham, Baylor College of Medicine, Boston Children's Hospital, and others. It's just been a great experience.
It must be hard, though, to study those. If there's, are there a lot of children with these? I know autism there is, but for the Rett.
So these are rare disorders, right, rare conditions. So Rett syndrome, about 1 in 10,000 to 1 to 15,000 girls, and so it's predominantly just girls, have Rett syndrome. Angelman syndrome is about 1 in 15,000 boys and girls. So, yeah, there are not a lot of those patients in South Carolina, so we don't have a big pool of patients to draw from. So in Rett syndrome, and geographically, initial participants were from the University of Alabama, Birmingham, Greenwood Genetic Center, and Baylor, which is in Houston. So we weren't distributed around the country. So to overcome that barrier as far as enrolling patients, we, working with the International Rett Syndrome Foundation, who funded additional funding for travel clinics, did travel clinics. We would go to Oakland, California, Chicago, New Jersey.
So much for that work and less thing. Yeah, okay.
So we would go there on weekends, twice a year at each site. So 8 weekends a year we'd go, and we'd see families from that geographic area. And we'd have usually 60 to 70 families come in over the weekend, and between the three, and then we grew to 4 sites. We added Boston, and the second phase of the study would enroll patients. So that we actually enrolled close to 1,200 girls with Rett syndrome in that study, as well as about 100 and so with related conditions, and some males, which are even more rare.
Wow.
So it was a great study, and actually we got refunded, so we're getting ready to embark on another 5 years with that. But what's been really exciting during that time period is see movements towards actual treatment of that condition. So there are two treatment trials ongoing right now that could have significant impact on the outcome for those patients and those families. And then Angelman syndrome, I think within a couple of years we'll probably have some treatment trials ongoing for that that could have significant life-altering impacts on those families as well. So that's the really exciting thing, I think, right now in genetics. You know, for so long we were able to learn more about a condition, what the gene was that caused it, what that gene did, and how that caused whatever condition. But now we're actually moving in the era where I think we're going to start actually treating some of these conditions and altering lives for patients and families.
Sure. Well, I mean, you're using a lot of genetics now in cancer, and in the cure of cancer, too. Yeah. Is that correct?
So, yeah. And so that's an area where I'm not as well-versed, because it's not something I do as much. But yes, I think oncology and cancer is much further along as far as using some of the genetic testing and genetic technology to dictate or direct treatment. So now we're starting to sequence genetic material in tumors, and depending on what the actual changes or mutations in the gene, then that directs which chemotherapy or which regimen, whether you're high risk or low risk, or what pathway you go. And I think we'll be seeing more and more of that in oncology as we go forward, and hopefully we'll start seeing that in other genetic conditions too.
Sure.
And start learning from what the field of oncology is teaching us.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I was thinking about Anna Jolie and her having a double mastectomy because her family had such a proclivity for it. And I wondered if we're going to see more of that, or do you think we'll be able to actually change the fact of even getting cancer eventually?
Yeah, that would be the ultimate. So that rather than having to have double mastectomies or other surgical approaches for a risk where you don't know when or if it's going to happen, if we could say, okay, we know you have this risk based on this genetic background, but we can alter that risk or change that risk by doing this that's less invasive and less traumatic than that. I don't know if we'll get there. I mean, that's our goal. I mean, that's what we're doing. I think we're starting to see that some of the other genetic disorders where we're starting to screen and starting to do interventions with treatments, diet, mm-hmm. supplements, whatnot for metabolic conditions. And I think we'll start seeing that for other genetic conditions as well down the road.
Well, what do you think about as far, do you have a lot of people coming for genetic testing now, like for cancers or for other things here?
So again, our focus historically has not been on cancer. But we are starting to get more and more patients that are being referred, either because their physician, their oncologist, knows that that's part of the workup and the management. So we are now doing oncology clinics here in Anderson, and there are other clinics that we help get started in Spartanburg and Greenville, and now being hosted by those hospital systems on their own. So we're starting to see more of that. We're also starting to see more patients just come in that are doing some of these direct-to-consumer genetic screening tests and mm-hmm. bringing in the results and saying, what does this mean? And that's more challenging.
Sure. And people are actually, the history of a person is becoming more important to what their future may be.
Right. And so one of our most powerful tools is still the family history.
Right.
Which doesn't take any significant technology to do, just a piece of paper and a pencil. But just getting that family history, we can tell a lot. Whether you're at increased risk for heart disease or hypertension or diabetes based on that. But then hopefully with genetic technology, we can start refining that risk a little bit and start hopefully outlining specific things that you can do beyond just, you know, watch your weight and exercise
sure.
and don't smoke and that kind of stuff, but actually specifically changing and altering outcomes.
Here at the Genetic Center, what has been some of the big breakthroughs, if you will, that have really put the Genetic Center, because I know the Genetic Center here in South Carolina is really on the map for doing great things. Yeah. But has there been anything in particular that was a real breakthrough?
Well, I mean, I think probably people won't see it as a breakthrough, but just developing a system that provides care for the whole state. So it's many states, it's kind of fragmented depending on where you live and who's doing this part of the state and who's doing that part of the state. So just having this uniform access to genetic services that covers the whole state, I think is unique and something mm-hmm. that we shouldn't downplay, just the importance of that. And not only the clinical services, but being connected now with all the medical schools in the state so that we're starting to be involved with training the future generations of healthcare providers as well, and getting them knowledgeable about genetics and genomics and how to implement that in their practice. I think the neural tube defect prevention program, neural tube defects are defects of the developing brain and spinal cord, spina bifida, anencephaly, encephalocele. Those are birth defects. They have significant impacts on the individual, but also the whole family. South Carolina, as well as the whole southern Appalachian chain, was at a higher incidence or higher risk of neural tube defects. In 1990, information became known. We didn't develop it, but it became known that folic acid, a simple B vitamin, if given prior to conception in the first 3 months of pregnancy, it could significantly reduce the number of neural tube defects. So I think one of the things that we're very proud of is that we, working along with the CDC, March of Dimes, DDSN, and DHEC, developed a statewide effort to use that knowledge to prevent neural tube defects. So it was a massive education program, education of the public, education of healthcare providers. It was a surveillance program, identifying babies when they were born with neural tube defects. We know those families are at higher risk for subsequent pregnancies, making sure that they were aware of that risk and putting them on a higher dose of folic acid to prevent future recurrences. And just making sure that vitamins with folic acid were available. That program started in 1990, and over the last 22 years, has decreased incidence of neural tube defects by a little over 60% in this state.
That's awesome.
Significant.
Absolutely.
What that means in human terms, mm-hmm. people terms, 70 babies are born in this state every year without a neural tube defect that in 1989 would have had a neural tube defect. So that's 70 healthy babies every year in the state. So that's an enormous impact on the state. Particularly enormous for those individuals and those families. From a state standpoint, from an economic standpoint, that's about $15 million a year that we're saving
in
the
dollars,
state just in healthcare costs. So that's something that I think was significant. And we, the program that we developed here is still held by the CDC as a model that other states in the nation should emulate. Not all of them have done it. And I think, again, it goes back to building on that base that we have of the statewide genetic services with the ability to implement something on a statewide service.
Do you think it has anything to do with the fact that we are a small state?
That helps. I mean, certainly when you have less than 5 million people in a geography that's, you know, smaller, it helps
compact.
Than if you were in California or Texas or Montana or someplace like that. So that certainly has helped to do that. One of the other things that more recent is the metabolic treatment program. So babies have been screened for, 50 years now for metabolic conditions. It's a little heel stick that every baby gets when they're born in the hospital, drops of blood, put on a little filter paper, and it goes to the state lab. Initially, they screened for PKU disease, but in 2004, that metabolic screening program expanded to 33 conditions. We were aware of that before it happened. This has been happening across the country. But we also were aware that screening was only the first part of the battle. You can screen, but then you've got to confirm that someone does or doesn't have the condition, but then you have to be able to manage and treat those conditions. And most of these conditions are rare, so that many times a physician only have one or two patients in their whole career with one of these conditions, or maybe never. And so they aren't going to be well-versed in the current management,
what to do.
So we worked again with DDSN and others at DHEC to develop the part of the program after the screening program. So what that is involved in, now we have two metabolic geneticists that are on staff. We tried to recruit them, but that was hard to do. So we actually grew our
own. You had to develop your own?
We had two. Then we sent them back for training, and they're board certified in metabolic genetics. Recruited dietitians, genetic counselors, psychologists, and clinic coordinators. And so now every individual, maybe a baby that is screened, if they flag as being at risk or positive for one of these conditions, notice goes to their primary care physician, but it also goes to one of our two metabolic geneticists, and they contact the physician mm-hmm. and the family and say, would you like us to be involved? And usually they say yes. And then we outline the steps. Okay, these are the next steps as far as confirming the diagnosis, and then here's the immediate treatment that you need to go ahead and do from a dietary standpoint or supplement standpoint. And then we conduct metabolic clinics in all of our offices. So we go to Greenville, Columbia, Florence, Charleston, Greenwood, so we're regionally based, so that families don't have to be traveling, you know, long distances to get the treatment
get the
management.
Help you need.
And so then we help working with the primary care physicians and the families manage those conditions. And with proper identification, early institution of a diet, we can prevent babies from having intellectual disability, from having seizures, and even from death from a lot of these conditions. So that's a significant impact on the state.
You're the silent heroes here. You're always kind of working behind the scenes, right?
It's one of those things that I think we really strive to. There's two things. The kind of the tagline on our logo now is where compassion inspires progress, and the other up in our lab, we GGC, playing off our initials, giving greater care. I think giving greater care and compassion is part of what we do. Our mission is to give hope to these families and eventually alter lives so they can lead productive lives. So that's what we're trying to do.
Now, as far as autism, though, what is the direction that autism is headed?
So So autism is one of those things that, because it is so prevalent now in society, a lot of resources are being put to trying to understand what is causing autism and how do you manage autism so these individuals can be productive. A lot of people have looked for a genetic basis. There are now actually over 500 different genes that have been associated with autism in one study or another. It's been linked to almost every chromosome and some regions of every chromosome. So I don't think the traditional method of genetics where you look for a gene and say, oh, we've got the autism gene, we just got to manipulate that gene and we can cure autism is what we're going to find. I think that there's probably some dysregulation of multiple genes that are involved in brain development, maybe prenatally, maybe postnatally, but that if they're either upregulated or downregulated, and it may not be all the same genes in the same patient, so that may be why we see such a spectrum in autism, but if they're involved in that normal brain development pathway, it's why what we need to be looking at. And we're pursuing a couple hypotheses now that have some potential very dramatic impacts on autism. One that we kind of stumbled upon, Dr. Schwartz in our research lab was looking at a platform that's used to look at how cells in the body metabolize different energy sources. Mm-hmm. It was really developed more for oncology uses than intellectual disability or autism. But he was just curious that if you put cells from different patients with different genetic disorders, would you see a different metabolic profile? And he had no preconceived notion of what he'd find. But so he put patients with Fragile X or Down syndrome or Rett syndrome or autism on there. And what he started noticing that the cells from the patients with autism didn't seem to metabolize tryptophan as well as other patients. Tryptophan's amino acid, it's in protein. Everybody thinks of turkey when they hear tryptophan, right. But it's in a lot of other meats and even vegetable products. But for some reason, they didn't seem to metabolize tryptophan as well. So the significance of that, and we're still trying to validate it and refine that a little bit, but right now, as I said earlier, autism's diagnosed by behavioral observations. There's no lab test, there's no x-ray test or MRI or anything that says yes you have or no you don't. You kind of look
at it. It's not one of those things you can prick the heel with and know that your child has it.
But if tryptophan holds up as a potential biomarker, then perhaps that could be used either to kind of confirm a diagnosis or ideally what we'd like to see is that still present prior to the onset of the symptoms? Is that tryptophan alteration in metabolism present before you even see signs of autism? So can you identify it earlier so that you can start early intervention early? So we do know that the earlier you identify children and start them in the ABA therapy or other therapy programs that are out there, the better they do as far as their language development, their inclusion in regular classes, and then ultimately independence as adults. So that's where we'd like to get them.
Sure.
So the earlier we can identify them, the better chance we have to do that. The other interesting part of the tryptophan story is that tryptophan feeds into some other biochemical pathways. It feeds into serotonin and melatonin and some of these neurotransmitters that have been implicated in other studies as being associated with autism. So tryptophan may be a common link to some of these pathways. And if you can put it in a metabolic biochemical pathway, then you can start seeing, okay, is it upregulated or downregulated here? And if so, then is there some compound, is there some medicine, or is there something we can do to get it back in balance? And then, therefore, can you come up with a treatment that may help the symptoms of autism? So that's one very exciting area of research that we're pursuing that could lead to both potentially screening or diagnostic testing and also to treatment. And the other is something that we've been looking at also as a biomarker or diagnostic test. It goes back to looking at various genes that are associated with brain development and looking at how those genes are expressed, and are genes overexpressed or underexpressed, and then can we detect a pattern that might say once you see this dysregulation of gene expression, it leads to autism. We had some preliminary work looking at that with some diagnostic technology. Had some difficulty validating it across all platforms, but we're still looking at that, still looking to see if one of those would lead to some sort of biomarker or screening test for autism. So that's kind of where we're headed for that. Our goal would be able to find some kind of biomarker or lab test, and then from there go to a treatment. And by treatment, we would like to look at a treatment that's not just the therapy base that's out there now, but something that actually is going to alter lifelong development from autism, prevent it if we can. That's kind of our goal right now. But
that's a big one.
It's a big goal.
That's a big one, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, just to bring us up to date, I know that the coming together with Clemson University, and then, of course, with Self Regional. Mm-hmm. What's this going to do futuristically, and where is it at? As far as I know, when Clemson was here, there was going to be new buildings and new partners coming in. Yeah. Where are we at on that?
Okay. So it moves slowly at first,
yeah,
but momentum is building, and I think we're really going to see a lot of exciting announcements coming out over the next year. So the building we're moving forward.
Okay.
A facilities committee has been formed, RFQs, I'm learning all these
newfangled terms
and things for construction, but has been sent out to architectural engineering team. So it'll be a Clemson building, mm-hmm, on our campus in the research park. We hopefully will select the winning team sometime in October so they can start the design process, hopefully start construction early next year of the building. So still a little ways before we see the building actually open and
sure,
research starting there. So, but it's moving forward, all the funding's in place, and the process
is
starting.
Some of the companies that are going to be coming here with this are pretty amazing, aren't they?
Well, we hope that that's what will happen.
Okay.
So I'll get to that in just
okay
a second. So the other component with Clemson is, in addition to the building, is faculty and graduate students. So Clemson has committed 5 new faculty members. So these are not existing Clemson faculty. They'll be relocated to Greenwood, but they will be hiring new faculty members in human genetics research, basic science research. So it'll significantly augment the research team in capacity that we have here, bringing new technologies with them, some experience that we don't have in some of the cellular biology or developmental biology. So that first position will be the Self Family Endowed Chair in Human Genetics. Search committee's been formed, posting has gone out, and we're starting the process of recruiting now. This is, we set our sights very high for this position too. So it's a $4 million endowed chair.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for someone that's a Howard Hughes Medical Investigator level, which basically puts you in the top 100 basic science researchers in the country. So that's
easy if you go for the top 100 here. You don't even have to worry about the rest, do you?
So, I mean, we're setting our sights high to get someone that's going to really bring a lot of credibility nationwide and internationally, and bring some research strength and efforts with him, and then let that person help lead the recruitment for the next 4 positions. So I think that the goal of that is to really strengthen the current research here so that we're more competitive nationally for federal grants, and also to start bringing more graduate students. So we've had a long relationship with Clemson as far as graduate students on our campus. We want to get to where we have about 15 graduate students here on campus. These are PhD students in human genetics. And then using Clemson's experience with economic development, particularly looking at what they did with ICARP in Greenville,
mm-hmm,
we want our vision and their vision too is that Greenwood campus will become the genetic ICAR. We just need a fancy name for for what that campus is going to be called, so that other companies will see what's going on here, both from a research standpoint, but from a diagnostic laboratory standpoint and the clinical expertise that we have, and want to be a part of that. We already have some good relationships with some major companies that we want to grow that. So it may start out with sponsored research, but then they may want to have some dedicated space here so that their researchers interacting with our researchers and continue to grow that too. So our long-term vision is to fill that 170 acres of the research park with buildings that are full of researchers, not only from Clemson and GGC, but other state institutions, but also other national and international corporations as well.
What a huge thing for Greenwood.
It will be.
It'll be a huge thing.
Very big.
That's right. It's kind of sounds kind of like the research triangle in Durham and Raleigh.
Somewhat
in that
like
area.
That.
Yes. And that just has created quite an economic stability in that area.
And much like Dr. Stevenson was told 40 years ago, we're told it can't happen in Greenwood.
But by God, it's happening in Greenwood.
<That's right. laughs>
Now, self-regional's part in this.
A significant part. So self-regional has always had a close relationship with Greenwood Genetics Center. We are the Department of Medical Genetics at that hospital, and they've supported us in many endeavors. But they've stepped forward as a lead clinical research hospital in this growing collaborative. They are part of this vision. Mm-hmm. They want to be a part of that. They want to do what they can to make sure it happens. So they've done a couple things. They've committed $5.6 million over the next 3 years. $2 million of that will help provide equipment in the new Clemson building. $1.2 million of that each year for 3 years will go to fund joint research projects between Clemson and GGC faculty members focused on key areas that kind of a joint team identifies. So we just announced our first $1.2 million of funded research. Five of the projects were in the area of autism, and one was in oncology diagnostic test development. Based on self-stipulations in the funding, and also on our desire to grow this collaboration, the requirement was that majority of the work had to be done here on campus, and it also required that there be blended teams between Clemson and GGC. So what we've done is created now these blended teams. All the teams have people from Clemson and GGC working together jointly. We're providing space in our current building, since they don't have a physical building here yet, to go ahead and get that up and going. And the hopes are that these will be basically kind of like pilot projects, and if they're successful, then they will generate additional grants that will go outside of this funding mechanism, mm-hmm. but to the NIH or the Department of Defense or whoever is funding research in that area.
Well, it's good to know that it's already started. You know, that's one thing
started.
I don't think that we know out there
that it's
already up and going.
So that's already started. The teams are already working and meeting and starting to pull things together. We had our, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, I believe, we had our first kind of joint meeting where we brought all the teams together and everybody shared what their goals were for their projects. And it was, even in that meeting, teams started seeing potential areas of overlap and collaboration where they said, well, maybe if we do this while you're doing that, this can even be a bigger project down the line. So
that has to be truly exciting to be part of this today.
It is, yes. And we hope that this is just the beginning of partners. So we are receptive to bringing in others besides Clemson into this partnership. So it's exciting.
It is. It's awesome. So, you know, as we finish up on this, we've talked about a lot of different things here. Is there anything I missed when we were talking about this here today?
I guess, and we talked about it some, but the focus on treatment, that has been a major philosophical mindset shift. I guess from historically, genetics was a discipline that tried to determine the cause best we could, and inheritance pattern and recurrence risk. But we didn't really have much to offer as far as treatment or changing the outcome. We started, it's been a little over a decade ago now, starting thinking that, you know, genetics is to the point where we're kind of on the precipice of moving toward treatment, and how do we change our mindset so that when we see a patient, we aren't just thinking about, okay, what caused this condition and how is it inherited? And
sure.
Yeah, but what can we do to change it? So
really giving them hope for the future.
Right. So we've formed a treatment task force, and part of their mission is to kind of be looking at the literature, what's out there, what's on the horizon, and bringing that to our awareness level, but also trying to help us think through when we see a patient, okay, if this gene's involved and it's effective this pathway, is there something out there? How could we think about developing a treatment for that? So this has been a process and a journey, and I think one of the two things that have happened to help us move in that direction. One, we were fortunate to receive funding from the Duke Endowment this past year to help develop some of the infrastructure for the treatment initiative that we're developing here. So that's given us some resources to do that. And the other is the Curry Endowed Chair in Medical Genetic Therapeutics. That's Boykin Curry, it's in his memory, Ravenel Curry, his son, and Ravenel's wife set up this endowed fund for the chair in therapeutics. So we're in the process of initiating that search. I think that will also, much like the Self Family Endowed Chair, bring in someone that has a national reputation in thinking about treatment of genetic disorders, head up that initiative here and start moving us more rapidly in that direction. So that's where we're going. And I think all these tie together. So you have to have the basic science research. You have to have the strong diagnostic lab with all the technology there. You have to have the strong clinical base. You have to have all the graduate students and new students coming in and all that working together to make this happen.
And a lot of money.
A lot of money helps.
Yeah, makes it come together. So I have only one final question to ask you. Are you working less than when you were in private practice?
I can't say. No, I guess the only thing is different. I don't get called out in the middle of the night like I used to. So, well, I get those 2 a.m. calls to the emergency room, but otherwise, no.
No, okay. Well, listen, Dr. Skinner, I certainly appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today, and we look forward to coming back out here and seeing more with the Genetic Center.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.